welcome to another episode of the Gaming Moguls Podcast, the only podcast where one host passes a successful dominance check over the other one and switches allegiance mid-recording. I'm your host tonight, Mr. Mark Teske, along with my co-host, Mr. Jacob Klopfenstein. Jake, how are we doing tonight?
Doing very well. And just to clarify for the listeners, this is a safe for work podcast, so don't need to worry about dominating or anything around these parts here.
Probably unsafe for Afghani tribes.
There you go. Absolutely. We got an action-packed podcast. Let's hop into it.
We do.
First, to start off with, we have the MogulCon, which we now have a new URL for, because turns out MogulCon is already a thing. It's a gathering of female business people who try to talk about business and stuff. So we're not them. So we changed it to MogulsCon.com. So if you want to see it, go to www.mogulsconplicated.com. It's also on our website. You can find it pretty easily.
Right now, that currently takes you to our registration page, where for $40, you can sign up for a full weekend of gaming located in Rosemount, Minnesota, and time to game with us and hang out and lots of other fun stuff. And eventually, that's going to very soon morph its way into a full website with lots more information about what you can plan for the weekend. At the moment, MogulsCon is going to be all day Friday, all day Saturday, and probably till about dinner time on Sunday. So come on down and join us for a great weekend of gaming. That is September 27th through the 29th, 2019 in Rosemount, Minnesota. MogulsCon 2019.
Yeah, it should be fun. It's going to be fun to play games. And we still have plenty of tickets and day passes. So come on down. It's going to be great.
Jake?
Yes?
Jake, did you just say day passes?
We do. We have day passes. How cool is that?
What?
I know, right?
Why don't you explain day passes?
So we just decided that probably there's some local people that don't want to come for the entire time and don't want to spend $40 to come over for just a day. So $20 per day if you just want to be here for a small amount of time. Come. It's going to be fun.
You know what? You can help us get the word out about MogulsCon, and you can help yourself and build out your game collection of quality Oink games, because we got a cool contest going on right now. Jake, why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So as of our last podcast, it's still going. All you have to do is tweet out a link or Instagram out a link to our MogulsCon or website URL. Just say that it's a con, whether you're coming or whether you think you wish you could come or all that stuff. And we will be giving out a copy of Trix and the Phantom that Mark picked up from Gen Con that is signed by Mr. Jun Sasaki. So all you got to do is tweet out our URL, and I will make sure to do that. Make sure to add us to @GamingMoguls on Twitter, and we'll add you to the drawing.
Yeah, for sure. And hashtag MogulsCon would be awesome, too. Instagram counts, too. Are we accepting Instagram, Jake?
Yeah, let's do it. Why not, right?
Right on. We're pro-Instagram. So speaking of Trix and the Phantom, why don't we talk a little bit about this one? I'm excited about this.
Yes, because we were lucky enough to be able to play it this past week. Why don't you give us a little description of what it is there, Mark?
Cool. So Trix and the Phantom is one of the 2019 releases by Oink Games. This is designed by Mr. Takashi Saito. This has been available in Japan and outside the U.S. for quite a while, and just was available in the U.S. as of Gen Con, and they had multiple copies of it, quite a lot of copies of it, actually, for sale in the Oink booth at Gen Con. So I've been waiting for a long time for this one and was able to pick a copy for myself as well as for you. And as it turns out, a third one for a lucky listener. So Trix and the Phantom is what I would call both a deduction and a bluffing game rolled into one.
And it's almost a trick-taking game, too.
Almost, yeah, for sure. Because what happens is everybody has two cards numbered 1 through 10, where the highest card essentially wins the trick, a.k.a. One is a bluff card that's really the lowest but can be bluffed into being anything else. 10 is the high card and sort of wins everything else. Other cards have special powers. I mean, think like the spy in Stratego, right? The spy beats the general. It's that sort of thing where certain roles will beat certain other roles. So what you do during your turn is you put down one of your two cards and then you put down one of three markers on it. It's a car, it's a bottle, and it's a gem. And each one of those symbols represents one of three different roles in there. So you're basically saying, hey, I'm one of these three people when you put it out there. Or maybe not, if you're playing the number one, which is the Phantom. You can lie and say you're any one of those three. And then after everybody's put their three down, you have some knowledge about what card is in your hand, as well as what card you threw away to the pile. And you then bet on which card you think is the criminal. The criminal's actually the highest numbered person in that hand. Everybody that basically guesses it right gets a point. And if you're the only one to guess it right, you get more points. That's a pretty cool mechanic.
Right. And then on top of that, if you're the person who played the criminal card, you get an extra point for playing the trick card.
Because you won the trick, you also get to lead the next trick, just like a trick-taking game.
Yes, absolutely.
Super, super fun. Well, and then the second time around, you play the one card you have left, so you have even more perfect knowledge the second time around. But weirdly, it seems like bluffing became an even bigger thing, and that didn't help as much as you'd think it would.
Yeah, it's interesting. I really like this game, and we actually haven't talked offline in regards to what we think about this game, so I'm hoping you feel the same way as me, but this game is really interesting, and I'm interested to try it at different player counts, because it's one of those games that is drastically different depending on the number of players.
Sure.
You're always having two rounds where you're going to play some cards. In a two-player game, I think you have two hands, technically, but in a three-player game, what's cool is you're actually dealt three cards and you pitch a card out, which does not happen in a four-player game. So you actually have way more information on the board state than you would in a four-player game, and it turns out in a really fun way. And because there's less players, you score less points, so it's less swingy. What did you think of it, Mark?
Oh, I thought it was super fun. It was very interesting with the knowledge that you did have, the knowledge that you didn't have, and deducing that, along with just trying to metagame and just mess people up so they try to bet on you in the wrong place. In fact, there was one time that I knew you were going to win, and I purposely bid on the wrong thing because I knew that if you just followed me and I bid on what I knew was the winning card, I knew you'd follow me and that would give you the last point to win the game. So I purposely bid on the wrong thing just to try to get you to follow me.
Right. And I did things like that too. And it kind of gets to that level where it's like that scene in The Princess Bride where the bald guy is talking about the poison between the two cups, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right, where it's how many layers deep are you going to go with this lie? Where it's like, well, then he's going to assume that I did that to do this, to do that, to do that. And it makes a really fun board state and a really fun little game in the Tricks and Phantom here. I was very pleasantly surprised. I would put this as a top tier Oink game.
I would agree with that too. This is definitely a tier one Oink game. You know, we sort of got tipped on that one when we did our review of upcoming Oink games back a few months ago. Yeah, it's really nice to see that it held up as it was portrayed to us that it would.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I'm going to add this to the play often bag. The only thing that's an issue is I think it's only going to work well with three and four. I haven't tried with two, so maybe it would be fun, but my assumption is it's a little bit constrained depending on number of players. And then with our Mogul scale, which is a quick way that we give the game its first a number that's 1 through 5 that associates its rules complexity, and then a letter that's A through E that describes its strategy complexity. What would you give it, Mark?
So the rules are super simple on this one. I pretty much just taught you how to play the game, but there's a little more thinking involved with it. Not deep thought. I mean, it's very quick deduction. So I'm going to peg this one at a 1B on the Mogul scale.
I completely agree. I think that's exactly right. Tricks in the Phantom. It's a fun game. I think we'll be talking about this one a lot moving forward.
For sure. Next game we got a chance to play was a game that we talked about last time, the latest Sashi and Sashi small box card release designed by Sashi, called In Front of the Elevators. We both played it individually. This is our first chance to play it together. And wow, we played it at four players and it absolutely lived up to its billing once again.
Yeah, no, we're big fans of this one, too. It seems like we've gotten a bunch of great small box games to the table in the last couple of weeks, and this one is no exception. Functionally, what you're doing, listen to our last episode, so we won't give too long of a description here, but you're playing down cards that get a cut in front of other cards, and you're making three different lines, and there's certain scoring positions depending on where you are in line in those. And so thematically, what it is you are all waiting in line to go to different floors of a department store, and you get to play down these different people who are trying to go to different parts of the mall or department store, or wherever you want to say there. But it was awesome. I really like this game, too. I think it's going to be one we're going to talk about a lot. But we have one big announcement with this. I think this is the first time we've done this, Mark. We are changing a Mogul scale.
Upon further review, the judges have overturned the ruling from last episode. And we've decided to rethink and reevaluate our number because we were wrong. Jake, what did we give it last time?
We gave it a 2B. And there's no way it's a 2B. That was silly. There's we got to no give way. Out more ones, you know. If you don't give out ones, then twos become a dumb number that encapsulates too many things. So this is a one. It's about as simple as it could be. You play a card and it cuts in front of another card if that number exists out there, if that different aged person exists. So it's about as simple as games come.
A couple thoughts with this playthrough is, number one, you were absolutely killing me during this game with your little just comments, Becky, Barb, right. Let's do lunch. Because whenever you have three of the same roles, they all just decide to say, oh, screw it, we're going to go have lunch together. And
It's the most hilarious thing, especially if you imagine just a group of like three grandpas getting together in line and they're supposed to do something. You know, there's a reason they're Marvin. At the thing, and they just say, oh, no, Bill, let's go get lunch. And they grab the three guys that they don't remember and just come get lunch. It's hilarious. It's a fun game.
That was hilarious. So I was trying to do a little strategic upgrade on what I was doing. Like, I realized that having the double scoring guy on each elevator in the final round when it scores the most was super important. And so I pretty much sacrificed doing everything else just to sneak in a couple people into those double scoring positions. And that worked really well.
Yeah, I think you won by a lot, right?
By a huge margin. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to get away with it again. But yeah, that was my plan on this one, and it worked well.
Right. Just some thoughts on this game for me. It isn't a card game, so you only have two cards in your hand. So it's a lot dependent on what you can draw and what's going to be available for you to draw, because you can draw from any one of the five suits that are present in a four-player game. And so if you're in a situation where there's only really one suit to draw from, or none of them that you really want to draw, depending on what cards have been played, you can really be hamstrung by the draw there. And I think holding on to cards until later in the game so people can't cut in front of you or lunch you quickly with the double scoring points is very important in that game.
The other thing I was doing too is I would always draw my own color card if I could.
Yeah, me too.
If I couldn't though, I'd make a point of drawing somebody else's card and then just completely torching their placing them at the back of some lines so that there was no chance they were going to score or lunching them on the spot.
Right. And I would actually, this is the first time I tried to do this, but because it's an open information game, you know what cards are out there. So let's say there's a yellow card, a blue card, and a green card that you can draw. And you functionally can try to piece out what members of the family for each one of those colors that hasn't been played yet, so you can figure out what it was. And I remember it was a situation where I really didn't want my guy to be lunched, and there was one more grandpa hanging out. And if anyone were to play that grandpa on that line, I would have been lunched. So I was trying to draw into getting a grandpa, which is fun that that level of complexity and card counting exists in this light of a little game.
And my grandpa was one of those grandpas, and he was in the double scoring position. So I was holding that extra grandpa, and there was no way that guy was getting lunched.
Yes. Unbeknownst to me, I kept on trying to play into that and making sure that I was going to get hurt. But I ended up not winning this game, but it's fun. I think we'll, just like Tricks in the Phantom, I think we'll be talking about this game a lot. It might get the Arboretum treatment here.
Oh, for sure. That's In Front of the Elevators by Sashi and Sashi.
Yes. After this one, we got to play another game from Asia that we were very jazzed about. And I had no real impression of it before we started playing. So I am, of course, speaking of Walking in Burano by Wee Min Ling by Emperor S4/AEG. So you picked this one at Gen Con, right?
Right. You know, this checked a couple of my boxes at Gen Con. First up, I actually visited Burano back in April of this year, and just one of my favorite places I've ever been. It's so beautiful. It's so peaceful. It's this island just off the coast of Venice that is filled with these extremely colorful houses. It's a lace-making colony, and tourists just go out there for the day to just sort of stroll around and eat ice cream and look at the pretty buildings, and it's just a super chill place. And if the weather's nice, like, it's the greatest way to just spend a day just hanging out.
Right.
So I was very interested in the theme because this game is about building colorful houses along a canal in Burano.
Right. And they did a great job of it. I think it is one of the most implemented art into the game. When you look down, we took some photos of it. We'll have to post on Instagram, but it looks like you built a little street.
And what's funny about it is I looked at the photos. I'm an architectural photographer in real life, so I took a lot of pictures of the houses in Burano. And man, they nailed it in the game. Like, all the little architectural features I found in the pictures, like the streetlights and the roof lines and the chimneys, they were absolutely bang on with what Burano looks like in a cartoony fashion.
Yes, absolutely. In a weird, almost anime fashion, all the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
The scoring characters have a little bit of a anime tinge to them.
The other reason that I was excited about this game is the publisher Emperor S4. I'm a big fan of their games right now, between Shadows in Kyoto and especially Hanami Koji. I'm very interested in what this publisher does and am automatically going to look at any game that they come out with.
Yes, I have liked both of those games that you have taught me, and I think we should play them more.
For sure.
Why don't I give a quick description of what you're actually doing in this game mechanically to build these beautiful little buildings? So there's three different decks that correspond with different floors of a building. There's the roof one, there's the middle floor, the second floor, and then there's the base ground level. And each one of these are shuffled up, and then you're put out a whole market of them functionally. I think it fluctuates depending on the players, right, Mark?
Correct, yes.
Right. And so functionally on your turn, you get to draft a column of those. And each card has a whole bunch of features that may be on it. There might be a little picture of a little cat. There might be some flowers. There might be some succulents, which are a different version of potted plant. There might be some windows. There might be on the ground floors. There might be different businesses. There might be all of these different parameters to which then you are going to build your own buildings with these cards that you've drafted. And then there's these different scoring cards, whether they be tourists or people that live there. And they're going to give different ways to interact with these different building things. So there's one that scored points for cats. They were a tourist that was really interested in cats. And so if you place them underneath your building, all of your cats within that building are going to score extra points. On top of the point scoring, there is some constraints to building these different roads and your different buildings. And you can lose points from breaking those rules. So for example, all of the floors of a certain building have to be the same color. Because that makes sense. Why would somebody paint their house two different colors? Because then the homeowners association will get all mad at them. Or the colored of house must be different than the house next to it. Because again, that doesn't look aesthetically pleasing. So that's kind of the how to play the game. But I think it results in a really fun combination of mechanisms. I love games that do this where it has different scoring icons and things along those lines that are hidden in a very aesthetic package. So for example, the cat is creatively like jumping from window to window on the second floor, or sitting in some window, or hanging out on the roof. I'm using the cats for some example. I'm not some big cat guy. I just find them very cute. And I find that so interesting that it's hidden within the cards that just look like something else. What did you think of the game, Mark?
Oh, this is great. And what's funny is we played this together Sunday afternoon. I went home for dinner and then immediately taught my family how to play. And we played it right afterwards.
Oh, that's awesome.
And everybody absolutely loved it, and my family as well. The neat part about how you draft is you have to draft inside the same column out of the market, and you either have to take from the bottom up or the top down. You can't just pick and choose which ones you want. So if you want a middle floor, there are always three floors. If you want a middle floor, either somebody has to have had taken either the top or the bottom before you, or you have to take it with a top and a bottom. And you always get a number of coins. You know, if you take ground, medium, top, you get 0 coins. If you take two, you get 1 coins. If you only take one card, you get 2 coins. And then you have to actually use those coins to build. So there's this tension on having enough money to actually put them down and build your thing, and to do it before somebody else finishes all 5 of their buildings. Because if somebody finishes all 5 of theirs, you just finish out the round and you're done. And if you haven't finished all your buildings, you don't actually get to pick another scoring tourist or resident that gets you all the bonus points at the end, and you're going to lose. So it actually, in our second game, there actually was a race to the end there where literally in the last round, the card I needed to finish my 5th building didn't come out. There was no blue middle floor in there. So I had to put a scaffolding in there in order to put the top floor on there. And then I ended up using one of my 3-point rule breaker chips in order to put a different color in the middle there and break that rule. And it ended up working. And like, I still lost to my wife as usual, but I got caught out with not being done before everybody else finished.
Well, that was my instance in the first one. I was the only person that used 2 of my rule breaking chips because I knew the game was going to be over and I needed to finish my buildings to be able to score something.
This whole thing plays out in probably about 30 minutes. It's a very short game. It's also a quite small box. If you've ever seen Hanami Koji, it comes in the same size box. It's 4 inches by 5 inches or 6 inches or something like that. And so it's definitely a small box game. This is not currently available, but will be available in September, I believe.
Yeah, that's at least what BGG is saying and AEG's website. So I'm got this one on my radar. I'm going to pick up a copy, and hopefully the follow-up version of this, which is called Walking in Provence in the south of France, is it's supposed to use the same mechanism, but in a fun way. So hopefully that one will be fun too. What would you give this on the Mogul scale, Mark?
I would rank this it was about a 5-minute teach, a little bit thinky. We're going to call this a 2B.
I absolutely agree, which is Walking in Burano by Wei Ming Ling and Emperor S4/AEG.
Also got a chance to teach Jake another game that we talked about in a previous episode that I referenced, and I was able to bring it out and share it with the group of people, and we got a chance to play it. I'm referring to my game of Gen Con Time Chase by Jonathan Woodard II and Renegade Game Studios. For a little bit of background, Time Chase is a trick-taking game where time is a factor. You can actually travel back in time and change the results of previous won hands to affect the ultimate result. So you basically, if you lost a hand, you can go back in time and play a trump card on that one so that you are now the winner of it. Game is done when you have successfully won three rounds, which is harder than it sounds because the past is constantly changing, as it turns out.
Right. People keep on going back and screwing around with your stuff.
So you being a big trick-taking fan, Jake, you picked this up super fast. What'd you think of Time Chase?
I loved it. So it's interesting. This is one of the games that I think you could have played with more traditional gamers, people that play like Bridge and all those kind of games, if you were just use a regular deck of cards. But this one comes with a special deck of cards and comes with some other resources, which is what you use to travel back in time. But I was immediately a fan of this game and found it very interesting, the fact that people are allowed to just all of a sudden be the only person playing against an existing card on a past trick. So for example, if you're three hands ago, that's say a six of orange one, you can go back in time to there. And if you're the only one there, all you have to do is beat a six of orange, and then that new trick in the past becomes yours. So it's really neat. People kind of pick on each other in the past and end up taking away other people's position and stuff. But I really like this game. I ended up winning it, and hopefully we'll pick up a copy of Time Chase pretty soon, because I think my family will absolutely love this game.
Well, and we actually both hit the winning condition at the same time. And you took the tiebreaker from me because you had a trick one that was farther back in time than mine.
Yes, I was an earlier winner than you. So I was a winner moving forward. But I did have one slight complaint with this game, and it wasn't for me. It was more for the person that's actually running this game. You have to constantly be just moving physical objects around all the time in this game. You're just gathering cards. You're shoving cards underneath these things. If people are changing things in the past, then you have to take cards out of that, replace it. It's almost like you want a dealer for this game, just because there's so many different card things moving on for how fast it really could be.
Yeah, that's true. There is a lot of physicality to this game in specific locations where people have to go and places that cards have to go. It gets worse in the advanced game, and I'm told that the advanced game is really the way to play, based on both the designer and the publisher, is the only way to play on this game. In the advanced game, you don't set out the years in numerical order, like you don't do hand one, then hand two. You literally shuffled up the chips and you deal them out one at a time. So you might start with year seven, then you do year three and you go back in time and play that one, and you keep putting them in the correct place. And when you bid crystals to move forward or backward in time, you actually pick whether you're going forward or backward in time. So what that changes up is you could be, you're actually, what's the present is actually maybe somewhere in the middle of the timeline. So suddenly now it's very easy to get to one end or the other, or you're maybe at one end and it's really hard to get to the other end, or it's really easy to get to the trump card, which is called the invariant, because late in the game, you know, a really early time chip came up and you all teleported back early in time. That sounds even nuttier, and man, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, because it became kind of deterministic at the end, because nobody could go back and change the trump, which maybe is a good thing. I don't know. I haven't played the fancy, incredible, beyond advanced version, so we'll have to try that one and see what we think about it.
Nope, I think definitely next time we play that, we're going to play that version of it instead, because that was, like I said, recommended to me by the publisher.
So what would you give Time Chase on the Mogul scale there, Mark?
Time Chase is very easy to teach. It's about the simplest trick-taking game in the world. If you've ever played a trick-taking game, you inherently know how to play this. You just have to be taught the time-traveling rules on that. So we're going to call this a one as far as rules go. And I think it's a, I think the first time you play it, you'd call it a C, and every time after that, you'd call it a B.
Agreed.
It's a little hard to figure out the first time you played it. So ultimately, on multiple plays, it's a 1B.
Absolutely. And I think it comes down to one of those things, too, where you have to know how to read your hand. And once you kind of know how to read a hand, you can functionally be able to play it a little easier moving forward. You know, you have your high value cards and all that stuff. But yeah, it was a fun game. I'm happy we got to play it. It's on my wish list. You added two games to my wish list, this and both Wargame Burano, that are very high on it. So I should be acquiring those sometime soon, because these are both awesome games.
Is Time Chase available yet? I'm not, I got it at Gen Con. I'm not aware. Is it available yet? I don't know.
I'm trying to not buy games. So I put it on my like want in trade thing, and hopefully people will not like some of their Gen Con acquiring stuff and trade it with me. But we'll see. I don't know if it's available. I'm trying to buy less, Mark. Consumption is killing.
Good plan. One way to get around buying new games is to play old ones. And we pulled a dusty old one off and played it again on Wednesday night. But actually, not too dusty. We've been playing it a lot lately.
I like the little bit of spite on again there, because this has been a game that I have played a lot in the last little while. And we don't really have much to add to it. The main thing I want to talk about is an expansion to it.
By the way, Jake, why don't you inform everybody what game we're talking about here?
There you go. It's called Chicago Express by John Borer, formerly Harry Wu, and Queen Games / Winsome Games. My version's by Queen Games. We talked about this in the last episode, and we've kind of talked about it a lot. It's a game I like a lot. And we pulled this out, and I was able to win with the one cert strategy of Pennsylvania Railroad, which was fun. But the only thing I really have to add to this is I did buy the expansion to this game. I was under the impression that it was really hard to get your hands on. And then I was on Amazon, and I don't really buy a lot of games from like Amazon or Cool Stuff Inc. or that stuff in the last while. It seems like most of the games I get are like either weird ones from Japan or Kickstarters or BGG trades kind of thing. And I just put in Chicago Express expansion and it was $30. So it comes with two different versions. It has, or two different modules that you can add in. One of them being these small narrow gauge track, which can be played for free. So if there's a very expensive part of the region, you can put that down, but it does not increase your revenue for the company.
It helps you bridge over a expensive spot in the mountains.
Correct. And functionally, what you can also do with that is it is not tied to a specific action. So you could say, okay, well, I'm going to take the auction action, chart the gauge for that one and plink it down one, and then actually do the narrow gauge expansion there. So that's one of the first modules there. The other module is a second small company that comes out a little bit earlier than the Wabash Cannonball comes in. So it'll come out whenever you like are kind of a third of the way through. Kind of through the mountains, kind of there's four cities in a row just towards the south. I think it's like Toledo and south. And once one of the companies reaches there, this new Erie comes in and kind of its goal is to, I don't know, but from reading the rules is go to New York and go there quickly. And it's only one share.
Interesting.
So that should be kind of interesting to play around with. I'm excited to play with that again and kind of breathe a little more life into this game that I love so much.
I am going to hold off my feelings on this game and my opinion on this playthrough until later this episode. Foreshadowing.
Right. Ooh. Right. It's almost like this gameplay kind of allowed us to figure out what we were going to discuss.
I'm not trying to be deliberately secretive. It brought up an interesting thought about what effects asymmetric starts have on skill level of players and the outcome of the game. And this was illustrative of some feelings that I've been having. And that's actually what we're going to be talking about as our main topic later on in this episode.
All right. Well, we foreshadowed enough. That is Chicago Express. Let's talk about some other small box games we got to play this week, Mark.
Fantastic. So one last small box card game that I got a chance to play with my son was a Gen Con pickup that I bought at the flea market for $5. So I came in with this having low expectations, and my low expectations were somewhat met. So did I get $5 worth out of it? Yeah, I got $5 worth out of it, but no more. I'm referring to the miniature version of Twilight Struggle called Twilight Squabble, a 10-minute card-based version of Twilight Struggle by David J. Mortimer, published by AEG. I love the theme, man. The theme of Twilight Struggle is one of my favorite themes of all. That whole Cold War brinksmanship, edge of nuclear war, let's, you know, geopolitical struggle around the world is so cool. I love it there. I love it in the Expanse board game. I love it in 13 Days. I love it in Watergate. And man, it fell flat, Twilight Squabble.
Really? So
it's too bad.
Why do you think it fell flat?
So a couple things. Number one is one of the great parts about Twilight Struggle is the thematicness of the game and how the fact that each card has something on it that dials directly to what the theme of the card is. So like if you get the De Gaulle goes to France card, you get to remove U.S. influence from France and add Russian influence in France. And it all fits together nicely. This card, in an effort to be really terse and concise, just literally just has, you know, a theme on a card and just an activation point number on it. And that's it. And every round you get a 1, a 2, and a 3. And essentially you're just trying to tug a war back and forth with your 1s, 2s, and 3s. And you have some opportunities to play a spy and peek at the other person's card and then put some influence points on yours to plus yours up and try to gain a point or two. But that's about it. We even played the advanced version where there's some events that happen that say that spies effectively double points, or everybody gets their double agent back or whatever else. even that didn't really push it across the line. And it played quick, fortunately. It played in the advertised 10 minutes. But we spent half of that 10 minutes in the rule book, I think, because it seemed like the rules were needlessly difficult and needlessly obscure for a 10-minute card game. And ultimately, we walked away from the game kind of going, I don't know that we need to play that one again.
Add it to the for trade pile, Mark. That's a bummer to hear. I just think it's something that sometimes when a theme has also been done in a shorter version already fairly well, because you like 13 days. Mm-hmm. What are you going to get more out of it with Twilight Squabble, right?
Well, another 20 minutes.
Right. I guess one is 30 minutes, but 30 minutes is still about as fast as games can get, you know?
Yeah. And I think that if I got 10 minutes to play a game, I own 50 games I'd play before this one.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a bummer to hear about Twilight Squabble. I bet you we can get all the angry emails from all the big Twilight Squabble fans on BGG.
No, this one isn't highly rated on BGG either, so I should have probably listened to it.
All six people that love it.
Yeah, I've almost bought it a pile more times, but I decided it probably wasn't worth $15. But for $5, I thought I'd see if it truly was that much of a stinker, and yeah, it kind of was.
So we do have one special game that we did also play this week that if you saw us on Twitter, you're probably confused about how we haven't talked about it yet. But we're going to do a bit of a deeper dive here. This is still definitely our first impressions. We've only played this game twice, but we have played it twice in a week and kind of want to dig a little bit deeper into it. I'm speaking of Pax Pamir 2nd Edition by Cole Worley and Whirligig Games. So Mark, before we kind of dive into the mechanisms of this game, why don't you give a bit about the background of what a PAX game is and B, kind of the setting of PAX Pamir specifically?
This is sort of the latest installment in an entire series of PAX games. And as a background, PAX means peace in Latin. And coming back from kind of the phrase Pax Romana, the period of time where things were all kind of well and smooth in the turmoil that was Rome. There's a number of games in these series, Pax Pamir, Pax Transhumanity, Pax Emancipation, Pax Renaissance.
Pax Porfiriana.
Pax Porfiriana, yep. They're all published by either Cole Worley or Phil Eklund of Sierra Madre Games. A lot of these games have really big, very rabid fans that have played them a lot. And the original version of this came out several years ago, and Cole Worley recently took another swing at it, refined the rules a lot, and upped the publication and production value of this dramatically, put it on Kickstarter, and was shipped out and arrived earlier this summer. And my copy has been sitting on its shelf waiting for its moment in the sun, which finally came this week. As a setting, Pax Pamir is about the Great Game. It's a period of time in Afghanistan and that area around there in the 1800s to the 1920s. In that, the Ottoman Empire and everybody else who had been ruling that area collapsed and disappeared, and suddenly the whole area was thrown into turmoil, and lots of different people were vying for control of that area. The Russians, the British, the Afghan tribes were all back and forth trying to get control of the area and established a little bit of order. You are playing tribal leaders who are building up a court of cards to influence that board. You're not playing the Russians, you're not playing the British. You're just sort of rolling with the tides with each one of those and hitching your wagon to whoever seems to be doing the best at that moment in time.
Yes, you're very opportunistic in this thing, which is attempting to replicate that time that we both know very little about. So I apologize if we got any of the background on the Great Game poorly. I will hopefully try to read some of the supplementary information and books that have been mentioned that are good times for this, but we know very little. So please don't send us angry emails about how bad we are at history.
And we're also going to try to very deliberately step around comparisons to this and other PAX games because personally, this is the only PAX game I've played. I'm going to be upfront about that one. And Jake has only played this and PAX Renaissance. So Right. We are not experts in the PAX system by any stretch of the imagination. So we're just going to talk about our experience with PAX Pamir.
All right. So I think the best way to do this is kind of explaining the mechanisms of the game and describe the implementations of what that is trying to do, like thematically, and then also the implications of what that means in the game state. So functionally, Pax Pamir is a tableau builder. And what a tableau builder is, which, oh my God, if you don't know a tableau builder and you're trying to play Pax, that'd be a spooky decision. But a tableau is a set up of cards that give you special abilities and powers. So you get two actions each turn, and your available actions that you get to do at the very start of the game are buying and playing cards to your tableau. And then once you play cards to your tableau, you get new actions that you can then trigger on that specific card. Whenever you play a card, It's also going to have something called an impact action that is going to change the board state in some way. It might change whatever the favored suit is, so certain actions are free. It might put some more blocks out there. It might put little roads. It might do all of these different little things that'll change the board state in some manner. Most of these cards are associated with some certain individual or some period in time or some concept to which they are named. So, for example, there might be some guy from England who's Joseph Wolfe or something along those lines, or Harry Pottinger, and he might have some certain special ability or something along those lines. But why don't we describe each one of the specific actions in Constrained with each one of those actions they are able to get. So the first one you can do is build. Build allows you to put down more pieces on the board for whatever faction you are currently allied with, whether it be the British, the Russian, or the Afghans. I didn't see this action being used that much. We were in a kind of interesting board state where everybody was really poor. And because the build action is so expensive, two for a single piece, it seemed like people were more often drafting cards and playing them to their court to try to get those blocks out a different way. Would you agree there, Mark, on the kind of implications on the build here?
Yeah. So one of the chief things is there's a thing called a dominance check that comes up four times throughout the game. And literally, it's a count on who has the most blocks out there, whether they're roads or armies. They can be used in either way. And if somebody has four more than somebody else, they're dominant. And whoever is the most loyal to that dominant faction gets a bunch of victory points. Right. And I actually attempted to use that to get a bunch of blocks, and actually successfully, because I had a special power in one of my tableau cards that said whenever the build action's taken, I get an extra free block.
Well, your faction gets an extra block. I think we should be a little bit clear here on our defined terms.
Right. That's a great clarification. Our faction gets an extra block. So I'd do a single build in Kandahar, and then I would actually get to place an extra free block out there, which helps my tribe that I was loyal to, which happened to be the Afghans at that moment, become more dominant.
Absolutely. I tried to do it too. There's a couple of degenerate game states to which you guys were aggressively poor, and I was sitting on like $8 or $9. So I did this a couple of times to make it so you guys couldn't get the money back out of the market because it went on the more expensive cards. And I think that worked out pretty okay because I was trying to make a kind of neutral situation to which then I would win the second tier of the dominance check and get my own points. But it's a very interesting action that just putting pieces on the board can have kind of more and more implications down the line.
Yeah, one of many levers that you can yank to affect the board state.
And they're all interactive. Like every single lever seems to slightly affect every other lever, which is why I want to describe each action this way.
The next action that you could have on there is the tax action. It allows you to suck money out of the people that are in the region of the board where you rule. And if nobody else is in there, you can suck money out of the market. Out of the market, out of the game, it's actually a closed economy in this game. So money coming out of somebody else's pocket goes into somebody else's pocket, and it just basically pushes around. So if somebody's rich, that means that other people are poor. One way that you can get around that is you can tax people if you have that ability to do that. Unfortunately, I had some of my cards killed during the game, and one of the cards that got killed was my one that allowed me to do a tax action. So once I got broke, I didn't have any way to get out of being broke.
Yeah, so it's interesting. This is a way to get money, but it seems more of a add-on way to get money than drafting the cards. And maybe that's just because we don't play this game very well, which might be something that we circle back to a lot here. But it seems like drafting the cards, because whenever you pay something, you put it to the card market. It seems like that's kind of the best way to get money back in this game versus taxing people. Because the most powerful action version of this is like $1 or $2.
Three.
Yeah, three, right?
Maybe there's a three. I don't remember. There's a two for sure, but I'm not sure if there's a
three.
Yeah,
which doesn't seem that strong to be able to do it compared when most cards have $1 to $2 on them in a lot of points of the game.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that one. Towards the end, I looked at it and went, I could tax, but just taking a card is actually going to get me more money.
Right. So every single card has one of four suits on them. And depending on what the game state is, certain cards will be favored. And so there's going to be one of the suit is favored, and this is indicated on the board. And depending on what suit's favored, all of the cards then do not count as actions for you to take of your two that you're allotted. So I kept on using the tax action whenever the favored suit was up for that tax card. So functionally, whenever the suit, I think it was on yellow, allowed me to tax for free. And it seemed like that's kind of the big time you're going to use the tax action. It doesn't seem as good as kind of the other ones.
Yep. Yeah. If you can just suck an extra buck or two just randomly. I mean, at one point you were sitting with, you know, $9 and both John and I had zero. So couldn't have been all bad.
Yeah. I was driving the game state. That's the tax action. Moving forward, if you get all these this money together, the next action you can do is gift, which is where you can give a gift to the faction to which you are currently allied with. And we'll talk about switching factions in just a little bit. It's either $2, $4, or $6. And you take this and put them back in the market. And then you get to take one of your discs, which is a secondary tracked resource or, I guess, influence marker.
Yeah.
And you put those to kind of indicate that you've given a gift to whether it be the Russians or British or the Afghan forces.
Yeah, the reason you want to do this is that's one of the things that is counted towards who's the most loyal when a dominance check has happened. So if one of the factions is considered dominant, you look at who's the most loyal to them and you add up like the gifts that are in there. You add up if you have any patriots, they're kind of like special powerful dudes in your tableau. And there's a couple other things that you look at as well. So that's just, it's one of the factors that makes you more loyal to a specific faction than perhaps somebody else.
Right. Well, then beyond that as well, if let's say we're in a tug of war and that nobody's really gaming and dominant to everybody else, the next thing that's checked is whoever has the most discs on the board, which is what you use to track gifts and agents on or spies on other people's cards and tribes out on the board. That is then checked. So by gifting, you both remove a disc for the secondary dominance check, and you're also more dominant with the people to which you are allied with than you normally would be. So this one, I actually ended up using a gift towards end game to be able to get an extra cheap disc on the board so I could tie John and keep in first place.
Yep, I did the same thing, but too little too late.
Right, absolutely. So that's the gift action.
Okay, the next action you could do is something that often I was able to do for free just because, again, the favored suit tended to sit on the thing that I had the ability to do this as a free action on most of the game. And that's the march action. The march action allows you to move armies from one province to another if you've built a road there, or it allows you to move a spy from one card to the next. Everybody's tableau is connected like a ring. And so you can literally march your spies around the board to get over to somebody else's tableau and start raising havoc on them. At one point, I had so many free actions with moves that I basically was doing Sherman's march to the sea.
Yeah, just like, well, I'm going to move here to move here to move here to move here. Okay, cool. Now I can kill your one guy. That was a lot of work to kill a guy, Mark.
Well, yeah, but at that point, you were sitting with the faction you were loyal to had a pretty solid dominance marker in there. So I needed to get your blocks off the board. So I was just running around just bashing your blocks in every way that I could.
The reason why you move your spies around is if you have spies, which are those discs, whether they're on the board, they're called tribes, whether they're on your faction gift area, they become a gift. And then if they're on other people's cards, they're spies. You can then shut down that card ability so people can't use part of their tableau without paying you a fee. And you can also do the next action with it, which we will talk about in a moment.
Yeah, and this is something that is a really, really swingy part of the game for sure.
Right.
Jake, why don't you go ahead and tell people what that is?
Got it. So I'm talking about the betray action. I think it was called assassinate in the first edition of it. So what you're doing is all of your tableau is kind of representing people in your court. And so you can assassinate any card to which you have a spy on if you have the ability to do so in your tableau. What that does is you can remove that card, which then they can't use anymore, and it'll affect certain tracked stats that they have. For example, if you kill some guy that increases court size, then when it's at the end of their turn, they might have to discard even more cards off of their thing. And then the really heavy hitting thing of this is the overthrow rule, which is whenever you lose a card that has a certain region on it, let's say Punjab, and that's your last card that you have in Punjab, all of your other tribes in Punjab are removed as well. And the vice versa of this happens as well. So if you lose all of your tribes in Punjab, you must lose all of your cards in Punjab. And so it really can change someone's situation very quickly. So John was in a very aggressive lead with us when it came to discs. He had 8 out, and I think me and you both had 3 respectively.
Right.
And we were looking towards a very stalemated board state, and we wanted to make sure that we were all similar in discs. So Mark and I targeted John to try to take out all of his discs we could, and we removed his discs from, I think he had 8 on the board at the start of his, or at the end of his turn. And then before it came back to him, he was down to having 2 discs on the board.
Right.
Because we were able to, I think I spied somebody that got a bunch of tribes to come back, which then he wasn't ruling there anymore. And then I think you killed a tribe in another region, so they need to get rid of a card that had two more guys on it. And it really changed his board state.
And not only that, it gutted his court because he lost a bunch of cards. And it gutted his pocketbook because some of those cards were leveraged. Leverage cards means that you get a essentially a loan from the central bank until the card goes away. Then you got to pay that loan back. So by losing that card, he then had to pay money to just get rid of the card. And by the time it came back around to him, he was completely gutted. It was ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely. It was honestly kind of sad. I felt like a dick. But he was clearly winning at that point in time.
No question.
And so it was beholden on us to change the state so that we would be able to make sure he didn't win.
Well, and I actually was the downside of a bad betray also, because you at one point came in and marched a spy over into my court, betrayed that card, and that was the card that increased my court size. Suddenly now I'm like, oh, I'm two cards over the top of my court size. And in order to discard things that I could discard, I had to discard another card, which decreased the size of my court size even more. And by the time I was done with all that, I think four cards came out of my court. It was horrible.
Yes, it's absolutely brutal how interactive this is and how many different levers to which you have, which is, again, the recurring theme here about this game.
The final lever is something that's a little more obvious in any dudes on a map game, but has some really far-reaching secondary implications. And that's the battle action. The battle action is exactly what it sounds like. You take one of your guys and knock out one of their guys, whether it's a spy or whether it's a block or whether it's a tribe. You can just beat those up and kill those out of there. And I had free actions that were both march and battle. So that's when I was doing my Sherman's March to the Sea. And that's when I cleared out all of John's tribes. And I went through and I cleared out a bunch of your armies and just kept on rolling until you finally decided to blow up your own roads so that I couldn't get into your province. It was wonderful.
Right. Feng Shui, I was doing that every single time. I would just be like, nope, not doing any more roads. No, I'd destroy your roads.
Oh, that's
not
right.
My
roads.
Yeah.
Because you can't destroy your
roads. I would just always destroy your roads just to make sure that you couldn't come in and had a big old holdout somewhere. So it'd be way too long for you to get in there. So you wouldn't come screw with my blocks. But yeah, the battle one is most simple. But just like as we said with the betray action, if you use, let's say, the British army to kill some tribes of your competitor in that region, and that's the last tribe to which he had there, then they have to discard all the cards in their court to which match that region. And every single card has a region. So you can really, really gut some people's positions just by using the resources to which you have available.
It was really profoundly interesting to me how many different ways you could accomplish something simple. Like, we need to decrease the number of discs on the board. Well, we could attack as tribes. We could attack as spies. We could attack his cards. We could attack his money. There was so many different ways that we could affect that end that it really became almost an efficiency play on what's the best way to do that.
Right. Well, and then beyond that with the levers as well, you can switch your faction allegiance. So we didn't talk about this because there's not one specific action for them. But whenever you play a card with a different patriot, which has a little bar, so let's say it's a Russian patriot on the thing, then you're now loyal to the Russians. So you have to get rid of all of your cards to which are not that faction. Whenever you betray a certain cards can be used as gifts for other factions. So if I kill some big enemy of the Russians, then they may find me loyal to be able to give that to them. So that can be used in that way. And I can switch from things. So let's say John's done a great job of making the Russians really strong and has a great position. The Russians are doing great, but he only has one influence with them. I could betray a card, switch to the Russians, and then maybe acquire another card and pay that card and build it or something on the Russians. And now all of a sudden, John in this scenario, put in all of this hard work to make the Russians really strong on the board. But now I've taken over and they actually like me more because I've both given them a gift of some guy's head and I have this other guy in my court. So they have their dude there is watching over me.
And I think that's a key factor of the game is the opportunisticness of the game where you really have to be head on a swivel at all times, ready to jump ship, ready to move, ready to take advantage of any opportunistic little loophole that somebody leaves you. And likewise, too, man, you're always checking your 6 o'clock to make sure you're not leaving the back door open.
Well, and also, it gets to a point, too, where you get so in your head about what you're worried about people doing, you forget little rules. Yeah. Like just simple things, right? Where it's like, oh, I can't get rid of that card, but then I can't get rid of this card. Okay, I'll get rid of this card. Oh, I can't get rid of that card because then my court size will get smaller. And then it can get a little AP because there's just so many hyper interactive small actions and little things that are stacked on each other. And if you really Jenga piece out one versus the other, your whole Jenga tower can fall over. And so you can get really lost in the minutiae of all the details here and not see the forest through the trees.
Yeah, and the one I kept forgetting was the fact that you actually can only build in a place that you rule, and I had been completely leveraged out of ruling any place, so I couldn't build and put more blocks out there because I didn't rule anywhere, and I kept forgetting that one.
Right, which is why we were doing that, because you could, whenever you ruled anywhere, it was just like a glut of British troops would come on the board.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you nailed it with there is a monumental amount of things to consider. And the board state shifts a lot between your turn and the last time. So there's a bit of you kind of can't really make up your mind on what you're going to do till it comes around to you. Like you can sort of get an idea of what things you're interested in. But until you really can size up what's going on, it's hard to tell exactly what you should do until it's your turn.
Right.
That definitely leads to a little bit of downtime in AP. Man, those decisions are tough.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any real way around it besides time of play, because there's a dozen different ways to skin the cat of making John lose some of his discs, let's say, for example, with what I've been offered. So which way am I going to do it to make it the most efficient? Am I going to try to play some cards to do some things? And then every card has so many different impact icons that are all kind of the same flavor of six different things that can happen, but there's different combinations for every single one. So there's just a little bit to consider in this game, to say the least.
That's one of the interesting aspects of this game, is that the user interface fundamentally is very stripped down and extremely simple. I mean, it's a very streamlined game from a rules perspective. There's really only six actions. The iconography is pretty clear and concise. There's a couple of gotchas you got to understand, a couple of gotcha rules. But once you understand those things, it's incredibly brain-burny versus the amount of rules overhead that there is to get playing.
Agreed. So before we go to kind of our thoughts about this game, I do want to take a little detour into a conversation about theme in games. A lot of people that I respect a lot, that I listen to and talk to on a regular basis, consider this game very thematic. And I also consider this game somewhat thematic. Actually, I consider it thematic. I'm just going to fully say it. This game is thematic. I will agree. But a lot of people who are especially history people and into this time in history will say that a certain card, like, for example, there's some people that I hear talk about Pax Renaissance, will describe like a Protestant uprising in Hungary or something, and that being really neat. I don't quite think a specific card that says some specific person's name, like Henry Pottinger, and has a combination of six impact icons that may be different but are one of six functionally, and a handful of actions that I believe are six of them that you can do, and maybe some text that might indicate a special rule, necessarily makes a game thematic. What's your thoughts on this, Mark?
You know, this is a tough one because we had a long conversation about this prior to coming online tonight about this specific topic. And I sort of probed your thoughts on this one to try to figure out, well, Jake, is any game really actually thematic then? And what really makes a game thematic to you? And your first response was an interesting one. You said, well, a game almost has to be a simulation in order to be thematic, where, you know, a game like Captain Sonar, where everybody has a role and they're doing a specific thing, is really thematic because they're actually doing that thing.
Right.
18XX being thematic because you're really buying and sharing, selling shares of a stock and operating it. So that's very thematic. And viticulture, because you're making wine and selling it, is what you're actually doing. So that made perfect sense, but that really kind of knocks out the thematicness of a lot of different games. My counter argument is, I said, hey, is Twilight Struggle thematic? And you said, oh, yeah, absolutely it is, because...
Absolutely, yeah.
Because why?
Because when you do an event in Twilight Struggle, it will have some specific rule that's completely different to other event cards. So it might be like place influence in six regions in Eastern Europe, for some example, or Charles de Gaulle, we talked about him earlier. You remove all of the U.S. forces there and put in XYZ amount of influence into the Russians. Or in Cuba, for example, Castro has a card and he removes all of the U.S. things and then adds in a whole bunch of Russian things. And that feels more thematic because it's changing a game state for a specific card. Every specific card that we've seen so far, aside from the event cards, which are somewhat neat in this game, so we're just going to gloss over those packs, is a combination of a handful of impact icons and a handful of actual tableau actions and maybe some passive abilities.
Yeah.
And I personally don't believe that that amounts to any amount of thematic integration beyond what it should be. I think that it makes it very immersive, but I think there is a delineation for me personally between what a thematic game is and an immersive game is. I think an immersive game can be thematic, and definitely an immersive game helps a game become thematic, but it's not necessarily a game has to be incredibly immersive and has all this great art and all these great pieces to have you really consider it thematic. Another litmus test I try to use with games, and I think this is interesting to use here, is if you were to strip out all of the art and just make this completely a most beta prototype of any prototype, if you were to watch people play this game, what theme would you assign to it? And Mark and I did this for this, and which one did we come up with for PAX?
So this is awesome, and I want this to be made. And we were riffing on this one, and like this would be the coolest game ever. We think that this could be easily transplanted into a prison setting. And like, I want to have PAX Alcatraz, where there's different factions inside the prison. I guess I could get a little weird, but think about it. You could actually have a case where you've got shifting factions in there that are all trying to get territory and maintain control of territory. And they give gifts and they, you know, they betray each other and they battle. And it fits in that theme almost perfectly.
Right. And so I guess that's the question is that theme and prison? I bet you could do this a lot of different games, right? Is the theme of Afghanistan and the great game, is that being replicated here? Or is it really just trying to be thematic about a shifting allegiance and a shifting board state and people having conflict and all this different stuff to make it do that? And I think my opinion has changed since we had that argument to now when I'm actually saying it, because I do think PAX is a pretty thematic game. I just really, it's a weird pet peeve of mine when someone says like, oh, well, this and this happened, when really all that is it's a card that says Henry Pottinger and he's in Persia or something, for example.
Poor Henry Pottinger. This guy might be the coolest guy ever. And we're just sliding him tonight.
Well, it's funny because I looked through for all the cards to find that was simple. And I tried to find one that I think I could pronounce correctly. And I'm still probably pronouncing it incorrectly.
It could be Pottinger.
Pottinger. Yes.
So I think one of the biggest strengths of this game is perhaps one of its biggest thematic challenges. And that's the fact that this game has a very simple user interface. It has six actions, and those six actions may not actually be rich enough to really deeply convey a theme in the same way that a game like Twilight Struggle does. It gets very granular in how it manages in each individual card. Whereas if you try to abstract everything out to one of six actions and combinations of there, is that a challenge for it to be highly thematic? And I think you have a point, Jake. I think it might be.
Yeah, I mean, and not to say this game, I mean, you're literally playing on like a rug. The board looks like a rug. And we haven't talked about the presentation of this game in any real detail, but it's gorgeous. And it really conveys this kind of art style of the region. But what you're actually specifically doing, I think you could wash it out. Because I know nothing about this time in history. I mean, the most I've heard about this is from like a Top Gear episode when they're in this region. You know, it's not something I really understand. So hearing people describe some historical thing really doesn't really convey the theme to me here. So,
and I also think that, you know, you do have the benefit of having played PAX Renaissance, and I have PAX Transhumanity coming this fall. I'd really be interested to play another PAX title just to compare and contrast and see if it plays completely differently because of the theme. Maybe it does. I don't know.
Right. And we're newbies here. Let us know what you think about it. But before we move on to our other conversation, why don't we describe how we actually like and feel about this game?
Perfect. I'll grab the ball first and run with it. So this is an interesting one and an interesting challenge going into it, because I've been pretty vocal about the fact that I hate dudes on a map games. I think they move around too much. I get really frustrated when I try to, you know, trench in and defend a territory, and then somebody plays some dumb card that just nukes me out of there, and all my best laid plans just got blown up. So I was worried as to whether I was going to like this one, and honestly, I love it. I think this is really an amazing accomplishment in gaming. I think that the combination of levers is so rich and so diverse that I think you could play this 1,000 times and never have one come out exactly the same way and never get sick of it. And that is really an amazing accomplishment in game design for me. I think it needs a lot of plays to really unveil all of that variety. I think that, you know, we're still just infantile stumbling around in the dark trying to figure out what levers to yank. And I'm sure anybody that's played this a number of times is laughing at our discussion going, "Oh, you idiots." But it didn't ultimately end up triggering my dudes on a map hatred because I knew going into it that it was a game about shifting allegiances and that you're just trying to ride whatever wave is coming near you at that moment.
Right.
And being that that was the thesis statement of it, I didn't feel like I was getting my birthday taken away on every turn.
Right. Well, and you are a step removed. That's why I think it changes things because, okay, well, you built a good standing with the British, but okay, I betrayed the Russians. I'm British now too. You know, like you're not the only person who's doing that. And because you're a step removed from that, I thought that this would work out well for you. I was hoping it also worked with Imperial 2030, but that's a conversation for another day.
To be fair, I think I probably need to give Imperial 2030 another go around now that I understand it better. And we also need to change that so we have more financial actions in there so it actually feels like a financial game. But I think I probably do need to give that another roll now that I have a little better perspective on it. So where I think this one might suck the atmosphere away from, though, and I'm worried about this one because this is another game I want to play really badly, is I'm worried that this and Root are going to compete for gameplay and table space atmosphere. And I don't know what to think about that because I love both of these games. So Pax Pamir versus Root, fight!
Right. And it's interesting because your summary is kind of the same thing as me. I love this game. I am enamored with it. The production's wonderful. I really love, as I said before, all of the different levers you can do and all these different hyper interactive matrix of different things that exist in this game. But I'm worried for the same reason you're worried. We play games often. We are very lucky to have a great game group, but we are not like other people where we play the same game that we know we're going to play from the get-go. And I think that's what you really need with PAX to have it really shine. So what we did is we played on Wednesday, and then my wife was working on Sunday. So I said, hey guys, why don't you come over? I'll make everybody lunch and play it again while it's still fresh on the mind. I don't know if we'll get presented another opportunity like that where everybody knows PAX and we can just dive right into it. Really without a lot of effort put in our personal life for this game. And which is sad because I think that's what it really needs. It's a very fragile game that I think everybody needs to know what's happening in it and play somewhat optimally to make sure that they can check people's powers and all that, things like that. And I'm just really worried we're not going to give it the right time of day. I think it's going to be kind of similar to, I agree with your thing of Pax Premier between Root of being kind of competing, but Root is way more friendly of an entry game into this kind of like, well, everyone's kind of doing different things. People are betraying stuff, you know, it's got a board, but things are different. They're not similar games in what's actually going on, but I agree with your sentiment, Mark. I could see these two games competing for table time with each other.
I almost am getting like a golf analogy here, right? That golf is a game that unless you do it all the time, it's going to be a painful experience, a really painful suboptimal experience, and you're going to lose a lot of golf balls. And if we only pull out Pax Pamir 2 once a year, there's going to be a lot of gaming golf balls lost.
Yes. That being said, I want to join a weekly golf group for Pax Pamir. I'm going to put this game in my game bag for a while. I'm going to just play it a bunch. I'm going to try to bully pulpit this game to the table because I like it so much. And I think it's such a fun game. There's still so much to learn from it. And I mean, we barely scratched the surface. I mean, towards the end of the other game, we kept on going like, oh, look at all these things we can do, you know?
Man, there were so many interesting things that happened that just amazed me that, you know, that pulling that lever gave that result and that, oh, I can affect this game in that way. That's interesting.
Wow.
You can remember that for the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. I love PAX. I hope we get to play it more. I'm just worried that we're not going to give it what it deserves as a game. This is not a game for people that want to play games like reviewers and play games twice and then kind of move on from it. This is a game that you should play a lot, play with people that also know how to play this game and kind of can learn all the depths to which this game can really offer.
And as a result of that, Jake, let's wrap her up and give it a Mogul scale. And we actually were pretty unanimous on this one. There was not a lot of controversy on our Mogul scale rating. Jake, where'd we land?
A strong 3E. If we had pluses, it'd be like a 3 plus E or maybe like a 3.5 E. But yeah, it hangs out there. It's not as complicated as it seems. Actually, what you're doing, you're just doing simple actions. There's just implications between what you're doing is amazing.
Right. It's Euro game difficult. I mean, it's if you can play a midweight Euro, you can understand the rules to Pax Pamir. The strategy, on the other hand, is a doctorate level course.
Absolutely. Well, Pax Pamir, play it. It's awesome.
Highly recommended. I love this game and I'm glad we played it. Now, this is a great segue into what is our main conversation. You ever notice that our main conversation is this like little ghetto jammed at the back of every episode?
And it'll take like 3 minutes because we don't have a lot of time.
But this is a topic that I've been formulating. I've formulated this theorem now over the past few months, and I finally sort of voiced it this week in somewhat specific, understandable terms.
And to which I pushed back against.
Well, yeah, but I think ultimately we reached a point where we agreed that there is something to this, and correct, that it's perhaps something that we need to consider depending on the game. And a lot of the games we've talked about tonight were actually representative of this theory and this concern that have been bubbling up inside of me. What it is there were games that Jake would want to play, you know, or that Jake would bring out, and I would just go, oh man, I don't know that I want to play this one. You guys know how to play it. I'm just going to get my butt whipped. I don't know the combos. I don't know, you know, I don't know how to play this out. I can learn it, but well, that really actually wasn't really the issue, as it turns out. What it was realizing that some games are actually balanced intrinsically and some games are balanced externally. So what on earth do I mean by that? I mean that a standard Euro is intrinsically balanced, right? You can sit at any position in that game with any player color, and you're at least starting off with the same shake as everybody else. You may go on to play poorly and finish way worse than people who do know how to play it, but at least at the beginning of the game, you're on equal footing on that one. Some examples of that being games like Scythe is intrinsically balanced. There's multiple asymmetric fashions, and ultimately, they're close enough that it should be fine. Terra Mystica, another one like that, where there are a lot of different factions in there, and ultimately, some are better than the others. Like, you're not going to auto-lose just because you picked the witches. You know, most Euro games fit into that bin also. Where I was kind of starting to complain and raise questions about were games where they are player balanced, where they're intrinsically not balanced out of the gate, where there are things that are better or worse right at the beginning. And furthermore, a player that knows those things is going to do just way better out of the gate than somebody that's only played the game once or twice. And Jake, what are some examples of player balanced games?
Right. But before I give the example of these, is the kernel of truth that Mark just gave there is the thing is the crux of our argument or disagreement, I guess, here is I don't think that, and we'll talk about this in a bit, that by having pre-knowledge in a player balanced game means that you'll automatically win and whoop the butt of somebody else. But some examples of these are pretty much all the games that I wax poetically on over and over and over again. These are 18XX games. It's a lot of the cube rail games, so like Chicago Express and games like that. Twilight Struggle being a great example of this. Pax Pamir, Root, pretty much all the splatter games, and then almost every single game with an auction, especially ones where you are rewarded for winning an auction. Let's say you can put a piece up, for example, like Modern Art or Container or a game like that. But so that's kind of the kernel of this. And I'm sure you could hear Mark talk about this in the past. We talked about 1846, and I've been playing that a whole bunch in the last while, or Chicago Express and all these things about, and Mark would say, well, I just am going to get destroyed in that game. And this is kind of the kernel of it, because Mark, did you get destroyed in Chicago Express?
That's an interesting conversation, Jake. No, I did not get destroyed. I lost by what, $6 out of, you know, 54 to 48 or something like that?
Yep. You lost by $6, and with one more dividend phase, you would have won for sure.
Yet I look back on how I played and I'm not sure that I ever could have caught you. So like the end number was close, but I felt like I was roundly beat since literally the first auction.
Right. And so that's the interesting thing about this is with a game that's so balanced by players, and we talk about this in 18XX all the time, if people aren't doing what they, I'm putting this in air quotes, but you can't see, should be doing.
That's great radio, Jake.
Thank you. Right. If only we had the faces for radio, the faces for video, people would actually see things. But regrettably, we have the face for radio. But when people have a specific thing that they should be doing, or they should read a board state in a certain way, or they have actions that they should do that are beneficial for them, but also are beneficial for you, or by them doing that will hurt somebody else, and they don't do that for whatever reason, you can run away with the game state. So let's talk specific here. We're going to talk about the Chicago Express, the most recent play, because I think this is a perfect conversation thing of it. I invested early into Pennsylvania Railroad as the first auction. I overpaid by a bit, but I got it for pretty cheap. I think it was in a five-player game. I got it for like $14. Then Dennis hops on the next after the first dividend phase, and he pays less than I did, but not by much. And so me and him are both pretty invested in making the Pennsylvania Railroad a good company. So we're building out really fast, and we get to Chicago super early. But right before we get to Chicago, John ends up winning the third share of that. And so we're all evenly balanced, and he just runs it right into Chicago, and we all get our money, and he paid a lot for that share. So he kind of wanted to get his money back from it. The question is, under that circumstance, should one of us scabbed on the other? I think in a situation where if Dennis were to own two of the shares and I were to own one, or if that situation reversed, I think the onus is on the person who is the minority shareholder to kind of trash that company, because it's going to hurt them a little bit. They've probably gotten their money out already from it, but it's going to really hurt the person that's invested way more into that specific thing. And it kind of comes to this point of pass the buck on whose job it is to stop certain people. And when certain people don't do what they're supposed to do with that situation, it can really feel like the people who knew the game better won the game. But my counterpoint is that I don't think that that's true, because it's too unpredictable. It's kind of the poker analysis, if you will.
So what it felt like and looked like from my side of the table was you and Dennis teamed up and ran it across to Chicago really quick. John got in and, you know, relatively late, and that one just to sort of cash out marginally. By that point, the two of you working together ran up the price so much that...
Yeah, it was at like $40, and all the other ones were at like 20-ish?
12, 15?
Yeah, even less.
So you guys working together ran up the price to the point where I didn't feel that there was anything that I could do with either working with somebody else or separately to close that gap from that point on. And interestingly, because of the fact that you had an extra dividend, earlier dividend payout than Dennis, I sort of feel like Dennis buying in and running it there sort of locked himself in second place. Now, he did finish really close. I'll give you that.
Yeah, he was just as close as you were.
But the margin of victory essentially was that extra dividend payout early in the game. And I look back at the actions that I took. You know, I made money on everything that I did. I didn't leave really any materially extra money in there. Every place I focused my action got me maximum dollar every time. And yes, I finished close, but the two of you working together ran it up so far that I'm not sure what else I could have done.
So I think all you had to do was take an auction action and not actually do the auction towards the end of the game, so that I couldn't take two auctions on my turn and run out the B&O so the game ended. Because all you had to do was do another thing. You were making way more money than I was. I think I was making like $11 per OR because I only had one or two shares. And then you had more than that. You were making 20-ish bucks, but you had invested heavier. So you had a lot less cash on hand. And I think all you had to do is push to a game state to which the game will extend more. And there's probably a hyper little butterfly scenarios to which you could have done a million little things beginning. It's just the question of whether or not that is because of player knowledge or because of game knowledge.
Part of it was is that player knowledge allowed you to get that one of those three share companies early on for not enough money and get a lot back out of it very early on. Whereas had we have been more skilled in that one, we would have known to A, bid you up more than that one, and B, that, you know, the third person in should have tried trashing it or doing something like that. But none of us knew that, you know, right. None of us knew how to do that. So, you know, we're essentially just playing kind of stupid where we're just like going, okay, you got that company. We're going to go get a different company.
Right.
So anyway, it was an open thought on that one that was the table balanced going into it, knowing that it's an auction game and there are companies that are inherently better or worse than others in that game. Is the fact that you've played it 8 or 10 times put you at an unfair advantage over those of us that have played it, you know, once or twice or so forth? Yes, the end scores are close, but you were actually in control kind of the whole way through. I'm thinking out loud on this one, and it sort of helped formulate this theory that, yeah, maybe player balanced games that have an asymmetrical start are maybe more susceptible to a more skilled player running away with the game. Is that a fair statement?
See, I would disagree. And I'm going to use our game that we're playing of 1846 right now, or I'll use 1846, but not the specific game we're playing. You're playing right now with a game with five of us online, and all of us, or at least three of us, have played this online implementation of 1846 a bunch. Not crazy values. We're not playing like 200 times, but I think I've played it probably like 12-ish times in the last little bit of little stretch. So I know the game pretty well in the last bit of time. But due to that fact of this knowledge ship of the game and how much I've played in the last while, I played twice with two relative newbies compared to me in 1846, and I did not win either time. It's the poker phenomenon. In Texas Hold'em, if you are a wrench into the system and are not doing what you're like supposed to do, sometimes you can get some wins out of it because you're unreadable. You're not doing what people would have done in that situation. Maybe you're playing suboptimally and people are viewing you through the lens of a coherent strategy when really you're just throwing everything up and completely battering up the metagame. And so I would disagree. I would say intrinsically, if I were like put money on it, I would say I'd probably beat somebody who's new at Gaia Project more than I'd have a chance to beat somebody at Chicago Express or 18XX, for example.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm definitely not arguing the fact that knowing strategy in a intrinsically very balanced Euro game is valuable, because 100% it is. In a lot of ways, it's more deterministic, whereas, you know, a player balance game is less deterministic. I just think that the player balance game tends to reward knowledge in a somewhat random scrum. Knowing at least where the path to victory lies helps you get a leg up on the other players at the table.
So I guess the counterpoint of that is I have won Chicago Express twice of my eight plays. So I don't know if that's the case, because or at least the statistics that we have, I've played, and most of the time with Chicago Express, I was teaching it to people. I wouldn't win it. I think that actually me running away with the PRR was more of a fluke than anything else. And I was at my ragged edge. If I wasn't able to shorten that game down one more dividend phase, I would have lost for sure.
Sure. And well, I guess we just proved it, Jake. I've played it three times and I've won once. So I got a better win record than you. So never mind.
You're doing great. You're 33%. I'm at 25%. I'm garbage at Chicago Express. So yeah, I guess it's an interesting thing to kind of figure out which way it is. I think it's interesting. I think it's more easy to lose in a player balance game than it is to win, versus in a Euro game, like let's say Gaia Project, you can think back to a couple decisions that you made that maybe were suboptimal or something along those lines and say, okay, well, if I would have done this better, I would have reevaluated this or this, this, and this, maybe I would have had a better chance. But hell, I had nothing I could do to make sure that dumb Eric didn't token me out of some stupid thing.
Oh, come on. Now you're just pandering to him. You just made his day again by referencing him twice.
So, yeah, it's an interesting balance. And I don't think this is going to be something we're going to agree on or ever really come to a consensus with, because I think you think that player balanced games, the list that we've listed here, is more rewarding to rookie pairs. And I'd say it's more of the opposite. It depends.
I think, honestly, I don't know. Maybe it isn't actually different. Maybe it just feels worse.
That's true.
A lot of Euro games are designed to keep people in it till the end and have a catch-up mechanic and have ways to make you feel like, I'm a little bit of luck and I got a puncher's chance of pulling this out. Whereas a lot of player balance games, it becomes pretty obvious early on that you're not in this game, that you're just, you're hanging on till the end of the game.
Right.
And maybe that's what it's exposing. It's not that one is inherently better than the other. It's just that one feels worse.
Maybe it's one of those weird balance things where you can trash somebody's stock and it won't hurt your feelings here. But if you like attack one guy's dude, then that's your guy. That's Bill, that feels bad to attack your friend. So I don't know. I think it's interesting. And I'll leave one last story here to kind of drive my point home. We're playing the five-player game of 1846, which is another perfect example of the game that I have played a lot and you have not played. And the first like OR in 1846 is like, boom, it's like 0 to 100, just like that. Everybody's laying a crap ton of tiles. Everyone's doing everything, laying down tokens everywhere. Everyone's planning all their runs, Hell, the twos are dead by like OR 1.2, they're gone, And so.
Yeah, that was a fast takeoff.
You were a high float. I can't remember, but you were late in the OR sequence.
Yep.
And you were like, oh, God, my position's so garbage. And you were complaining in our little thread, being like, well, I'm out already. And I looked at your position. I'm like, okay, we have all of these things that allow you to get to Chicago really quickly. And you won't be tokened out of it because you're going to get there so much quickly than people. They can't really bother you. And all of a sudden, then you went to 0 to 100 just like that. And you would piece together a great combinations of privates with your major that you ended up getting, which is what you were complaining that you didn't understand out about 1846 compared to other games, is you didn't know how to value which private was worth what in those games.
What position am I in right now in that game?
I don't think you're as bad as it seems. You think you're in third? The question is whether or not people
I'm in worse shape than I appear because I'm pretty tapped out right now.
Yeah, it hits to a point where you got to have some shares, but we're getting too detailed on that. It's an interesting conversation. For sure. Let us know what your guys' thoughts are, whether it's a euro, if that feels, would you rather put money on the line to be able to play an experienced person? Or a player balance game where you can really throw a wrench in the game and their plans are going to be completely thrown out of line in a game like 18XX or Chicago Express, something along those lines. Let us know.
Sounds great. Well, hey, it's been a fun conversation once again tonight, Jake.
Yes, absolutely. They got to see the glimpse into all of our topic discussions. It seems so smart, but really it's just that we're chatting about games anyways and might as well have these conversations in front of other people.
Anyway, thanks for joining us once again tonight for the Gaming Moguls. I'm Mark.
I'm Jake.
Good night, everybody.
This has been the Gaming Moguls Podcast, co-hosted by Mark Teske and Jake Klopfenstein. Please find us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Feel free to join our Board Game Geek Guild, Guild number 3431. Find us on Instagram and Twitter, at Gaming Moguls. Or reach us via email, jake@gamingmoguls.com or mark@gamingmoguls.com. If you like the Gaming Moguls Podcast, please tell a friend. Thanks for listening.